You're here because a man who looks down on you from this end of the auditorium claimed a promise many years ago from Isaiah 43. Fear not, for I am with thee. I will bring thy seed from the east and gather thee from the west. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far and my daughters from the ends of the earth. And this man claimed this promise and many others, and he also prayed for you in claiming that the work that God was leading him into would reach young men and women from each of the 48 states. There weren't 50 then, but I don't think there's anybody here from Alaska or Hawaii, is it? But Dawson Troutman definitely looked forward to this very type of group that you're in here in this summer, meeting at the Glen to learn more about discipleship and disciple making. That's kind of an interesting thought. Well, we don't have too long tonight, and I know there's more to tell than there's time to tell, so I try to pick out some of the things that would interest you the most. Try to visualize a young fellow on a motorcycle wearing a leather jacket and whipcord pants and kind of hair going all different directions. And then try to remember that it was nearly 50 years ago instead of what you see all the time on the streets today. And he was riding his motorcycle back from San Diego and he ran out of gas. You noticed he was at the top of a hill. He coasted down into the as far as it would coast. And it drove right into a gas station, but it was a holiday and the station was closed. So he just shot up a word of prayer and said, Lord, I really need gas enough to get home. And pretty soon there was a big tank truck came into the station to fill the tanks underground. Got through doing that and looked over and saw this young guy with the motorcycle and said, you out of gas? And he said, yep. And so the guy took his truck, the hose that was attached to the truck, lifted it up and just drained out what was left in the hose into the gas tank and went all over everything and filled his tank and ran over. So he had to wait for it to dry before he could even start. So this was an everyday answer to prayer for Dawson Troutman. He also liked to pick up hitchhikers on his motorcycle and tell him to get on behind him. And he said, hook your chin over my shoulder. They didn't wear helmets in those days, so they couldn't do that. He says, hook your chin over my shoulder. And so while they were driving around these sharp hills and curves in Sepulveda Pass in Southern California, why he witnessed to him and tell him about the gospel. Well, nobody knows whether there was a slight bit of pressure added for the fact that he thought he might have to meet his Creator any moment. But this is the way he did a lot of his evangelism, was picking up hitchhikers, either in his motorcycle or a Model T Ford. And he was interested in trying to take the sissy image out of Christianity that it had, and particularly in that time, that Christianity was for old ladies and little children. And he was trying to project the manly image that the gospel had and could give. So he was, he liked to do these daring sort of things. In fact, he was very afraid of being sissy or doing anything sissified. He was rather small stature and just did everything possible to overcome this. He and his buddy were on the motor one time riding along. He got pitched forward and landed over on the street somewhere and kind of were knocked senseless. He was knocked senseless for a while. And first thing you know, he heard the ambulance siren and he realized somebody was going to put him in an ambulance. He said, what, me in an ambulance? Get on this motor. I'm not getting in an ambulance. So he got his buddy to get on the motor and they sped off on home. The next day he couldn't remember a thing and his buddy realized that he had been driven through traffic by somebody that was unconscious. Anyway, he succeeded in getting this image across. Collier's magazine came out with a story in September 1941 which had a story on called Onward Christian Sailors by Walter Davenport, who was, you've heard about the New Army. They were advertising the New Navy in those days. And the New Navy in 1941 was apparently a navy in which a sailor wasn't afraid to carry a Bible. And there were a number of sailors on the ships in those days that were witnessing, and their buddies, the non-Christian fellows in the Navy, just had never seen anything like it. Here, just the top paragraph, the blurb here in the top says, "They pray as they work. They sing unto the Lord as they go down to the sea. They rejoice with left hooks when men revile them. And they're just enlisted men in the United States Navy. Stephen Decatur turns in his grave. John Paul Jones rubs his hollow eyes. Farragut stops damning the torpedoes. It's amazing." And tells about Dawson Trotman and this thing that they called a way of life instead of an organization or a group. It wasn't an organization, it's a way of life, they said, called the Navigators. He said, "We've got 12 of them on the California, maybe 15. You can't tell. Today you got 12, maybe 15. Tomorrow you maybe got 18 or 20. They're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, praying with lost souls. Every ship in the fleet's got some. I don't know how many in all, and they ain't saying." By the time Pearl Harbor came along and the United States was suddenly at war, these guys were, who had been congregated mostly on the West Virginia, had to abandon ship at Pearl Harbor because the West Virginia was sunk. And so they were scattered throughout the fleet and were witnessing on all of the ships, a lot of ships, a lot of shore bases, and then spread to the Army. It was just an ideal time for them all to be scattered to the four winds to spread the word. So this was the beginning of a change in the image of Christianity as it was in that particular decade. Dawson Trotman's father was an Englishman who came to America to be a cowboy when he was 19 years old, about the turn of the century, 1900, something like that. He had in his ancestry a number of Church of England clergymen, and the family was an English family that went all the way back to 1066, which is as far as British history goes. And but this man, Dawson's father, just was really an adventurer, and he wanted to be a cowboy, and he'd be a cowboy for a while, and he'd be something else for a while, and just kind of drifted around the West doing whatever appealed to him. And maybe he was a hippie of those days, who knows. And he ended up in Bisbee, Arizona, working in a mine, and that's where his family, his three children were born. Dawson was the second child in this family, and weighed 2.5 pounds at birth and was not expected to live very long, but he did. And he picked up a lot of this adventuresome spirit of his father's, and the kind of the flamboyance, you know, anything for that was interesting and for a change. Why, just when something was going good, why, he'd drop that and start something else. Well, Dawson got a little bit of that spirit. When he was 11, they moved to Lomita, California, in Southern California. That's where Doss grew up. And through high school, every kid in the neighborhood knew him. Every kid in the town knew him, and because he was always making friends with little children and doing things for them. Intensely interested in every individual. I talked to some people who were kids with him in those days, or who were younger than he was. And they said they just couldn't get over how intensely interested he was in every one of them. He'd be so, they said it was almost embarrassing. You wish you hadn't brought the subject up. He'd keep asking questions about each person he'd meet. And he showed this intense interest in the individual, which is a natural trait with him, and later became, of course, one of the foundation stones of the Navigator work. Through high school, he had for a science teacher in the ninth grade, Miss Mills, who was interested in the way he just took over and dominated all the classes with his questions and his interest in the work. This intense interest went into everything, into classes, into studies, into whatever he did. He just had a very deep interest in it. And she also was his leader at Christian Endeavor Church, young people's group. She and another teacher. And they, to the best of their knowledge, he made a decision for Christ in the Christian Endeavor and was of the kingpin and the youth group there in the church. And this was all through high school, but then suddenly on graduation night, when he graduated from high school, he got drunk. And just threw the whole thing over. He decided to quit pretending to be a Christian because he knew that he wasn't living a Christian life all the way through. He was lying, and he was stealing, and he consistently did this. He had no power not to lie and steal, and so he just felt like such a hypocrite. He'd been stealing from the school funds that he was in charge of. He had begun by stealing from his mother's dime bank, and belonged to the Boy Scouts, was trustworthy and all those things that the Scouts are, and had joined the church. And he used to scrape his knuckles against a wall, a brick wall, to remind himself not to lie and not to steal, but it didn't do any good. He just kept on doing it. So for 3 years after high school, he just decided not to pretend anything, just let it all hang out. For 3 years, he just caroused around and did whatever people did. Pool hall, he smoked a big pipe, and he was often gambling. Gambling was the big thing that he enjoyed quite a bit. Of course, all the while living in those days of the 20s, probably wouldn't any of it be X-rated now, but it was pretty wild for then. And finally, he was stopped in a recreation park in Long Beach by a cop who gave him a big lecture and took his car keys away from him until he sobered up. He brought them back several hours later and gave them back to him. In the meantime, when Dawson sat there on the park bench, he prayed and said, "God, if you'll get me out of this." He knew his mother would just be sick if he went to jail. He said, "If you'll get me out of this, I'll do whatever's right. I'll go back to church." And a month before that, he had nearly drowned trying to... he and a girl had been swimming, and she started to sink, and he tried to pull her up, and he almost went under himself two or three times. And just then a boat came by, and another couple in it picked him up. But at that time, when he almost drowned, he had promised God that he'd do something, and he had forgotten it. So this time, he said he really meant it. And so when he sobered up, well, he went on back home, and the next Sunday evening, he went back to Christian Endeavor, the same church where he'd been going, the Presbyterian Church in Lomita. And, of course, Miss Mills was there, and Miss Thomas, and still the sponsors of a youth group, and they had designed a contest with verses to memorize, where if they memorized 10 or 20 verses, they got points for their team. So he memorized the 20 verses and got the points for the team. And I guess the prize was that one side had to give the other side a party, maybe throw pies at them or something. And so as he was about 3 weeks after he memorized these verses, well, he was on his way to work, and one of them, John 5:24, got to him. And he stopped, and he said, "Whatever everlasting life is, I want it." And then John 1:12 came into his mind, and he said, "Well, Lord, I'll receive Christ right now, whatever that means." So he figured that that was his conversion at that particular time, rather than the earlier times that he had professed to be to receive Christ. And he was 20 years old, and the change in his life really did take place then. He changed just overnight. In some ways, he quit swearing and did show a great lot of change in his behavior. He did have a bad temper, and that's hung on quite a while. He lost his job for losing his temper. And gambling stayed, too. He couldn't quit. He had a hard time quitting gambling. He had a hard time quitting smoking. He quit that 6 times. Finally, just in desperation, he was out in the field walking up and down and telling God that he had to get this get rid of this. And 1 Corinthians 10:13, of course, was the thing that helped him. And all these were verses that were in those 20 verses that he memorized for the contest. So naturally, scripture memory took a big hold on him as far as recognizing its power. And of course, everybody he got hold of from there on, he taught them to memorize scripture. And Miss Mills asked him to teach a junior department Sunday school class, six boys. And first thing you know, the Sunday school class ended up on a weeknight in his house, and he began to have these boys' clubs, and each boy brought another boy, and they built up the boys' clubs, Bible clubs, until there were a couple of hundred of them in these boys' clubs. Everything he did, he was still doing just wholehearted, headlong. Everything he put his heart into, he just put all of it into it. And this was another characteristic that carried right through into the Navigator's work, and that's why you hear messages today on wholeheartedness. And that's no accident. This is part of the Nav heritage. A physical thing that affected his personality too was he had what the term for it is coarctation of the aorta, a valve in the heart turned upside down or something, so that more blood goes to the top of the body and less blood to the feet. So his brain was always well oversupplied with blood. He was getting ideas faster than anybody could carry them out. And his feet were always cold, but that didn't slow him down. So all this, I think, had a part in it. And he was a great idea person. Also a natural-born perfectionist. And this perfectionism he got from his mother, who had to have everything so precise that she was miserable. And this, in turn, had at times an obnoxious effect on others in him. And some of you asked me to put in the bad parts, and so I am. His perfectionism made him really annoying to some people and impatient with everybody else who couldn't do things as well as he did. But at the same time, it also acted as a means of his learning how to meet the needs of an average person who didn't have this particular standard. He was always kind of trying to find ways and means to help Joe Dokes over the hump. And one example of that was the gospel team, his first gospel team that he had in Christian Endeavor, six volunteers, and he gave them memory work to do, memory verses to learn. As long as he gave them verses to learn, well, they learned them, and when he quit, they quit. And he realized that through that human nature naturally needs a prop, that we all need some kind of a push or a buddy or a challenge or somebody to help us to do things. And this was a big discovery, because this led to creating memory courses and other things that people could follow instead of something that would fail. And he kept trying to find the thing that would succeed in getting people to memorize and getting people to study. A lot of things he did for the first time, or the first time anybody around there had done them. He put on the first Easter sunrise service in Southern California there. Great big thing out on the hills with Christ is risen spelled out in flowers on the hillside. And people had never heard of an Easter sunrise service, but they had one. And people from all over the county came into this. The Boy Scouts did the park. He parked the cars, and it was a big affair. And he held a Bible conference in the church, a teaching Bible conference in the church where they were. This was a new thing. Another thing was a three-week evangelistic campaign. He just decided to have an evangelistic campaign in the church, and they did that. Invited the man he invited for the evangelist for the first 2 weeks was Erwin Moon, who was his buddy and makes these films, Moody Institute of Science films. Well, they had some of their first experiences together. He went to, he decided he wanted to prepare for the Lord's work, and he went to seminary for a year, Baptist Seminary in Los Angeles, where Charles Fuller was one of his teachers in Romans and Hebrews and Ephesians and so on. He learned quite a bit from him on study methods as well. And then he went to Biola for a year. And Miss Mills was helping to pay his board and room and so on so that he would have more time for ministry. In fact, she was sort of backing him to get him into Christian service. He volunteered as a missionary to go to India because he felt that India would be one of the hardest places in the world to go. Then the doctor told him that he wasn't in physical shape to go to India. So he decided to pray, "Well, Lord, if I can't go, let me send men to the mission fields of the world." These are some of his earliest prayers that, of course, have been abundantly answered. On Saturdays, he would go down to Miss Mills's and Miss Thomas's home and mow their lawn and do the gardening. And then over lunch, well, he would ask them questions and get counsel and advice from them on how to help his boys in the boys' clubs that were growing all the time. And someone mentioned, I think Chuck Madden mentioned, that this was probably one of the first beginnings of man-to-man counsel when he was at the lunch table getting help from these two Christian ladies on his ministry with the boys. They also, well, Miss Mills coached him in public speaking. She heard his first sermon that he prepared and critiqued that. And his first sermon, I think, was on the seven churches of Revelation. Thought that was pretty dramatic. But all in all, they raised him up just as their disciple. And he would take these boys' clubs and use it as a vehicle for getting ideas. One of his first ideas, if you've heard his tape, why, it tells about how he couldn't get the kids' attention in Sunday school, and he said he went out in the hills and prayed, "Lord, give me an idea." And the idea was to get the troublemaker and talk to him alone, and so ask him to help keep the peace, and tell him that he was allied with the devil in trying to disrupt the class. And so he learned from that speaking to one person alone was very effective. Well, this is another step in his education in man-to-man ministry. Well, this was one idea. Another idea was that he had heard this illustration of the Christian life being like a three-legged stool. Word, prayer, and witnessing are the three legs that hold up the stool. And he didn't like the idea of the Christian life being something you sit on or do sitting down. He liked something that was more active than that, so he changed it to a wheel with four spokes, a word, prayer, witnessing. And then he figured out that something that added up to what he called living the life, which later became obedience, would was that missing factor, because a person could be praying and they could be reading the Bible and they could be witnessing, but still could be way off in their life. And so this factor of obedience, he figured, was an essential spoke. So that was where the idea of the wheel came from, just trying to teach his boys how to live the Christian life. Then the idea of the little New Testaments, they'd get all banged up. They carry them in the back pocket and going to school and playing around. So they got Prince Albert tobacco cans and boiled them in lye and got them all shiny, and they stuck those New Testaments in the tobacco cans. So all the kids were carrying around converted tobacco cans and their New Testaments. But ideas, you see, were just coming thick and fast. And he carried this through. Oh, with the index on your Bible, too, the index on the side, that was something that just came. He saw this dirty spot on the edge of his Bible, and it was at the Gospel of John, so he always knew where the Gospel of John was, because there was where it was smudged on the side. And there was also a smudge at the Psalms or Isaiah or somewhere. So he figured, well, why don't you smudge it systematically? So he ended up putting this index on with the letters, so that this was just an idea that came from figuring things out. Find a better way to do it. He was always saying this. I don't know, it's been said by others, but he was also saying it. Find a better way to do it. And he always encouraged his men throughout the years to think. He says, think, and you feel nailed to the wall, you know, when he tell you to think. Before IBM was saying it, and IBM never says it very loud. They just say it very dignified, but he used to yell it at people. And one of the first lists of qualifications for a NEV rep was one he made up, I think, in 1953, which said, think. A man must know how to think before he becomes a NAV rep. And this whole thing was bound up in this idea of, well, just like that, getting ideas that come from applying yourself to the problem. And he had heard this, of course, this much quoted statement, God has yet to show what he can do through a man who is wholly yielded to him. And he, of course, prayed to be that man. And then it occurred to him later on that a lot of men should be that man. God shouldn't have to wait around for one man to be that man. Everybody ought to be that. Every Christian, to be normal, ought to be the man that God can use, who is wholly yielded to him. He was reading Hudson Taylor. He read a lot of missionary biographies in those days, and read Hudson Taylor's story and David Brainerd and E.M. Bounds. And he'd read about how David Brainerd went out in the snow and prayed for the Indians, and he thought, well, boy, where can I go out in the snow and pray? And so he just tried to take on every challenge that he had read about or heard about anybody else doing. This idea of accepting the hardest thing that was put before him to do. This was a factor in his life. He heard a message on claiming promises and decided to claim some promises of his own that God would give him. And he began to gravitate towards Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, and he claimed a lot of promises in that, among them the 43rd chapter and all those that many are familiar to you today, those Isaiah 58:12 and 42nd chapter. He had written in the margin of his Bible, given to me many times when praying about my life's work. Isaiah 42, I think, was that chapter that he had written. From age 23 to 25, the big thing in his life was prayer. He would be praying with somebody early and late, praying alone early and late. He would be constantly looking for somebody to pray with or praying out alone many hours. He loved the Word and he loved to pray. And his journal from that time is just full of references to had a prayer meeting with so-and-so on the hill from 4 to 6 this morning, you know, or us. And then at 6 o'clock, so-and-so joined us, and we prayed on till 7 or something like that. And then the day would end with a prayer meeting, or there might be an all-night prayer meeting. It was a very, very heavy time of prayer in his life. But even though he loved study, he loved memory, and he loved the prayer, he also was becoming very much convicted of the need for discipline in his life, or he would not get to it. And he experienced there the conflict of wanting to get to the Word and wanting to get to prayer and still not being able to without that prod of discipline, of schedule, and of pushing himself. And this became, of course, a principle which he applied to everyone he ministered to in later years. At about 25 was when he felt that God called him to a worldwide ministry with young men. And a friend had told him that there are 300 ministers of such and such denomination in Los Angeles without a pulpit. And this so impressed him, he figured, well, the pastorate didn't necessarily need him. So he would go. He took on a life motto that said, never do anything that someone else can or will do when there's so much to be done that no one else can or will do. So he was looking for that place that was unmanned, and he kept looking for the place of ministry that hadn't been filled yet. And he asked a buddy to go and pray with him every morning for as long as it took. So this buddy went out with him to the hills, and they claimed Jeremiah 33:3, and they prayed every morning from 5 until 7 o'clock. And they started by praying for their boys in the clubs, and then they prayed for more cities, And they prayed for all of the whole state. And then they began praying for every state, pointing on a map to each state and saying, Lord, let us reach young men in this state of Idaho and Indiana and so on. And they kept praying along there. And then they got a world map and they began to pray, reach out and put their finger on places like Okinawa and Formosa and little places and big all over the map and prayed for the whole world. And then about 40 days while they quit. They figured they'd either done it or else they were tired. I don't know which. But they were through. And they felt that God was going to answer. And about that time, Dawson was flat on his back with a case of poison oak or something. And the idea came to him as he was praying of getting some real sharp, dedicated guys, just a few, like gorillas, you know, a gorilla team, not the monkey kind, but the other. So he asked six of his friends to join him in a team, and they called themselves the Minutemen. They would be ready. The idea was the Minutemen of the Revolutionary War, which would be ready in a moment's notice to go and fight. Well, they'd be ready in a moment's notice to go and witness and serve God in any way. So they'd get on their motorcycles and they'd go roaring off to some remote place in Pasadena and have their all-day meeting with the Minutemen. And they had a daily dozen. They had to memorize a verse a day, spend an hour in prayer a day. They had to do about 12 things that they called their duties. Write a letter a day. Some of them were keep a journal and witness to one person a day. So they had all these rigorous things that they applied themselves, but they really hit it hard. They were going to be Marines. And they prayed that they would reach 2 million young people with the gospel through this work, this little handful of men. And they would pray that the boys' clubs would increase from 200 that they were then to 1,000. And they prayed for boys and girls, fishermen's clubs. A fisherman's club is what had influenced him quite a bit. That's a club of fishing for men. They taught people to go out on the street and witness and fish for men. The NAV notebook really began with that Minutemen thing because they kept business lists and prayer lists, and they kept their list of addresses and list of daily things to do, and they just kept all these little records down in their notebook, so that, and then when they got together in their meetings, they checked up on each other to see if they'd done it, and they just kept a real tight ship. Well, their strategy was with the Minutemen was to take a city at a time, and by taking a city, they would go in and they'd establish a fisherman's club, and then they'd grab off one guy that was really eager, and zero in on him to become a Minuteman, and or a disciple. Well, they really worked on that, and they'd roar east, west, north, and south to Pasadena and all these, I can't remember the names of the other cities that were listed, that they'd go to regularly. Whittier was one, Santa Ana. They'd go and have these big meetings and find one or two guys that were really eager to start. And after 9 months, they only took three cities, so they doubted that they'd ever reach the world. And began to say then that he began to see then that God would have him to train laborers instead of trying to do it the slow way. And he began to say God can do more through one man who... I guess that's all. I guess we're through. Well, just a couple more things. They put the prayer request in their Bible that God would soon bring us into touch with a mighty band of young men, strong, rugged soldiers of the cross with an eye signal to his glory. They were hunting for these really all-out guys, you know. And he discovered that one of his so-called converts that he had led to Christ on the street as a hitchhiker, he picked him up a second time, and he didn't show any signs of being a Christian. So this brought it home to him again. Without follow-up, you may as well not waste your time leading anyone to Christ. And so this began his conviction of the need for follow-up. And that's why these two convictions he reached, the need to build laborers and the need to follow up new Christians, began to build into his philosophy the thing that was the foundation of the Navigator's work. He had led Lila to Christ as a girl of 13, and when she finished junior high school, they were engaged. And then 3 years later, when she finished high school, senior high school, she was 18. They were married then. And they claim for their home, Isaiah 60:11, "Thy gates shall be open continually, they shall not be shut day nor night." And this was the original verse on which the Navigator home was founded. The idea of hospitality, of a ministry in the home, which has been unique in the Nav ministry throughout the world, and the idea of an open home. The first year of their marriage, they lived 6 different places, and Dawson saw his ministry as sowing beside all waters, you know, just helping everybody he could, wherever he could, and secondly, to target in on one man for many hours at a time. And this first man that from the Navy that he met, of course, was Les Spencer, and he began to spend hours and hours and hours with him, and he was the first navigator, so to speak. And through Les and Gurney Harris, the second man, they got started with the Navy fellas, and of course that spread later on to the Army, and the college work goes way back to the early parts of the, well, during the pre-war years. I think they got started with college people when the fleet was out to sea and there was nothing to do there. They got college and high school work going. And when Lawrence Sandy came into the work, it was he came to the high school work, actually. Dawson invited him to come and establish high school clubs all across America. And you didn't even know the Navigators had high school clubs. But this was a definite feature of it. And they were going to establish dunamis clubs. They call it dunamis clubs all the way across America in high school and college. But then the war crowded all that out because of such a boom in the servicemen's contact that it was pushed aside for the time being. All right, well, aside from Spencer's right arm, well, that's as far as we can go tonight.